Morning, welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on March 17, 2026. And time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PU Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Tony Olson, our Secretary. Commissioner Julietra Alphorn Crosby, our Vice President, is absent today. Also joining me is John Harlow, our CEO General Manager, Colin Willenbrock, our Chief Operating and Legal Officer, Al Thorson, Clerk of the Board, and Danielle Tovar, paralegal. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices at this time. At this time, I will say the flag salute and we welcome to join us. I pledge
allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Copies of the agenda are located on the Deputy Clerk's table near the entrance. Commissioner Olson, are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the published agenda?
I have no changes.
Comments from the public is item one on the agenda, and that is when the public will hear comments that will be limited to 3 minutes. Person shall be recognized to speak from the sign-up cards located on the Deputy Clerk's table near the entrance. If joining by Zoom, click raise hand or dial *9 if by phone. I will call on you to speak at the appropriate times. If you're on your phone, you'll need to dial *6 to unmute. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please step up to the podium, use the microphone, state your name, and indicate where you're from. Please remain at the podium while you speak and address the commissioners, not the audience. If documents or the materials enter into the record, please hand them to the deputy clerk. We'll distribute them. The board, we appreciate your cooperation with all our procedures. Please note that all motions receive an automatic silent second from the board. This ensures that all issues can be brought to the floor for discussion. So first up is item one, comments from the public. Are there any comments from the public on items not on today's agenda? Please raise your hand. I see no hands up online and none in the room. Okay. Moved on to item two, our consent agenda. 2A, approval of the minutes of the regular meeting of March 3rd, 2026, and the special meeting of March 3rd, 2026. 2B, bid awards, professional service contracts and amendments. And 2C, consideration of certification slash ratification and approval of district checks and vouchers. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Any questions, commissioners?
Can you give me a quick?
Yeah. You can tell a joke or something.
So far.
I know any that are appropriate. I know a lawyer joke, but I don't. Our legal staff here today. Awfully lovely.
No, we've got a big rebid, I guess, on power nozzle rebuild project. I assume we're going out and sharpening our pencils. I got a nod. That's all I need. Thank you.
Okay.
That's it.
I have no questions. I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passed. Now, so next, item three, our CEO General Manager briefing and study sessions.
Okay. Are there any questions we should have asked?
There you can tell her about
so scary.
We're gone. Made it into the room.
And you didn't even tell a joke.
No. This item is for the board and CEO General Manager. It's the best issues among ourselves.
You know, you've done the same thing. And you're not going to tell me.
Was for the bid awards and making sure that we had folks here to answer any potential.
Well, I could have come up with a lot. I got a lot of other check marks.
Okay, so our CEO General Manager John Harlow will facilitate the conversation with the remaining.
Good morning, Commissioners. So first up is Ryan Collins with what I think he and we all hope the final
one.
Right. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Ryan Collins, the District's Government Relations and External Affairs Specialist 3. Today, I am walking you through the final e-legislation report for the 2026 session, which just adjourned this past Thursday. This is a new one. My goal this morning is pretty straightforward. First, I'll give you a brief recap of our legislative engagement and tracking the session, grounding where we started and the volume of work we've been monitoring. Then I'll walk you through the final status of the bills we've identified as key legislation, including those that crossed the finish line and those that didn't. I'll also highlight briefly the legislation that failed to advance, as many of those concepts are likely to reappear in future sessions. And finally, I'll close with the top line of the proposed budgets that have now passed the legislature. Just a quick reminder as we go through the rest of this presentation that while the chambers are both done for the year, there is still some action left. Looking ahead, all the legislation that has passed the legislature is now being delivered to the governor for his consideration. Under state law, the governor has 5 days, excluding Sundays, to act on a bill once it's been delivered, or 20 days if the legislature adjourned within 5 days of delivery. So since now, we're now in kind of the 20-day count. In Washington, the governor has four options when considering legislation. He can either sign it, the bill into law, veto the entire bill, partially veto the bill by removing entire sections, or take no action, allowing the bill to become law without his signature. The governor does not have a line item veto authority, meaning individual sentences or words cannot be removed. With that, as you know, the 2026 legislative session was a short session, but still an active one. Our team reviewed more than 1,000 bills introduced this year, and of those, we tracked about 270 that had some nexus to the PUD's operations or policy priorities. Across the session, the energy issues of most interest to the PUD fell into three general buckets. Affordability, like the energy assistance for income-qualified utility ratepayers, managing large loads like data centers, and then also ongoing efforts to improve energy development and permitting, whether that's the transmission authority or our kind of prefab disclosure bill with labor and industries. Throughout the session, we engaged consistently with lawmakers, committees, outside stakeholders, and agency staff, and our advocacy is reflected in several of the outcomes you see here today. With that context, I'll shift now to our specific bills. With session now concluded, our high-level legislation tracker shows that all remaining bills we've been monitoring have passed the legislature and now with the governor. In one instance, a policy that we had been tracking reemerged in a new bill late in the session to keep it moving, and I'll walk through each of these bills individually. Starting with House Bill 2296, which saw some significant changes at the last minute. As I've reported throughout session, the bill originally included both meter-mounted devices and plug-in or quote-unquote balcony solar provisions. In my last report, I shared that only the meter-mounted device language remained in the bill. However, as the bill advanced through the Senate, additional safety concerns emerged regarding how these devices should be addressed in certain circumstances, and importantly, who should be doing the work and who is authorized to work on them. Following those discussions with stakeholders, including the Department of Labor and Industries, IBEW, several utilities, including us lawmakers, decided not to advance the bill, deferring policy work for the interim. In the end, the only surviving language remaining in the bill was investor-owned utility conservation programs, so nothing related to the PUD. So as the bill heads to the governor's for his consideration, we can safely say there is no operational impact on the PUD since the remaining provisions are only IOU-focused. Even though meter-mounted devices technology fell out of the bill, I did want to respond to Commissioner Logan, your earlier request about what these devices look like. I gave you guys a quick handout here that gives you a couple examples of those types of devices. The specific one you're looking at it's called a meter caller. That's one device that would be allowed under this bill or some of the provisions that were stripped out. Smart panels and some other types of technologies could also exist, but wanted to make sure that you saw what these things actually look like.
Thank you. This is very helpful.
Yeah. Next is House Bill 2151, which thankfully was one of the more straightforward wins this session. The bill hasn't changed since we first amended back in early February and received the governor's signature last week, so it's now officially state law. Though through an advocacy effort led by the PUD, the legislature adopted an amendment to streamline the permitting process for certain utility-owned prefabricated enclosures, including those associated with our energy storage and substation projects. These fixes directly respond to challenges our substation team raised about inconsistent occupancy requirements applied by LNI. With the exemption now clarified, our project team should receive reduced delays and fewer vendor barriers. Small but meaningful operational improvement. As I mentioned, the bill passed both chambers unanimously and already has been signed by the governor, which means its effective date will be June 11th.
A question on this bill, not really relevant to us, but I'm just sort of curious about the scope. So does this cover like school portables and stuff? I know L&I regulates that as well.
So prefabricated enclosures or manufactured homes, L&I has purview over. There's lots of different applications for these types of enclosures as they might pertain. Specifically, this exemption only applies to utility infrastructure.
Which it doesn't, isn't it in the substation?
Correct, yeah. So it's these enclosures are pretty particularly used for storing either energy storage. So when you look at our battery up in Arlington, that's an example, the enclosure itself. More importantly for our substation crews, it's just putting electrical equipment in there. So it's not housed. And that's been the threshold as the trigger of this occupancy.
Also, office space either.
It's not office space, okay, exactly.
That distinction I didn't quite understand.
Exactly.
Thank you.
What they call the doghouse.
That's a good question.
No.
Doghouse.
Please proceed back.
It's not like a temporary construction.
Well, so then when I got my first tour of a substation, the engineer was spoofing me.
Some of the old buildings and substations or the older substations were called doghouses.
So,
yeah.
Okay, that's good.
There we go. Turning to the transmission authority proposal. As you may recall, we previously reported on the proposal to create a new state transmission authority. That proposal was initially included in a bill numbered 5466, which ultimately failed to meet earlier key legislative cutoffs. As I noted in my last report, the bill was unlikely to advance this session. However, late in the session, the legislature to revive the underlying policy by assigning it a modest fiscal note and reintroducing it as a new bill, 6355. Like its predecessor, the new bill creates a state transmission authority, which focuses on coordinating rather than imposing mandates. That helps align the existing regional transmission planning through BPA, Northern Grid, and Integrated Resource Planning. That's the new authority will use those documents from those types of entities for its purposes. Importantly, for Snohomish PUD, the authority does not create near-term operational impacts, but may have long-term relevance for regional system build-out. This updated version passed both chambers and is with the governor now for his consideration. We will certainly be engaged with the state as they set up the new entity through rulemaking and policy guidance. Transmission development remains critical to the region's resource adequacy.
They can help pay for West Tech.
Say that one more.
Maybe they can help pay for West Tech.
That would be nice.
Yeah. Logical, too.
It's logical that you have this new entity.
I think it's logical that we look at the whole Western.
Yeah, but
at one time when we look at transmission,
we'll see what comes of it. But a couple other states have done this, and again, we'll see. I think the intent is good. Whether or not the execution is the best. Next is House Bill 1903, which creates a voluntary statewide low income energy assistance program at the Department of Commerce. This program is funded through the Climate Commitment Act or the State General Fund and would be in addition to the support that we provide. This is one where we're actively engaged and supportive. For the PUD, this program expands bill assistance available to eligible customers, has the potential for streamlined enrollment and eligibility through shared lists or auto enrollment, and could reduce staff time and frees us better focus for more energy to be put forward toward conservation and energy efficiency programs. The bill that passed both chambers earlier this month is headed to the governor. We see this as a meaningful tool for affordability that could provide additional meaningful support to customers in need, which is a consistent priority of our staff and for our customers.
This is a state program.
So it would be all through the Department of Commerce. It wouldn't necessarily fund like LIHEAP, it wouldn't go through the county. It would go directly to the utilities who participate. It is a voluntary program, so the PUD could decide if it wants to participate or not. If it chooses to participate, it would receive those dollars from the state as part of its effort.
So that last bullet about supplementing.
Yes.
Does that impact our ability to modify our programs or just whether we've qualified for this?
So what this last bullet point was getting at is they wanted to just ensure that if we are using state dollars, that we're not substituting those dollars with ours. So say you have $1 million towards a program now. If we got another $1 million from the state, we'd have $2 million. We couldn't necessarily reduce that million that we had put forward originally, but we can direct that to different purposes so long as it is headed towards this population.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering if, say, we're, it's like 8 million or 9 million,
yeah.
Recall. What if future, future the PUD decides you have to cut for some reason to make it 7 million? That then disqualify, that's what I'm trying to understand. What?
It's a good question. I think the intent is just to ensure that if you receive, say, $5 million from the state,
yeah,
that you're not ultimately cutting $5 million from your program, that, again, you're adding to, under CETA, the obligation that we have a certain threshold we need to meet that ultimately always increases. So it's, it fits within that.
Okay.
Finally, I have a new bill to report, HB 16 or 1960, which amends renewable energy tax structures. The bill aims to address a longstanding property tax shift between renewable energy projects and local residents. At the heart of this proposal is a new tax framework that would replace existing treatment for wind, solar, and battery storage projects by exempting their property taxation and imposing a new state and local renewable energy excise tax beginning in 2028. For the PUD, this presents a nuanced outcome. The policy is aimed at a legitimate problem, but it brings potential unintended consequences. We pay state and local public utility taxes in lieu of property taxes. So the exemption for property taxes wouldn't apply to our projects. Importantly, though, the PUD does not currently have any projects that would meet this threshold. Arlington is slated to be 25 megawatts, which would be above the 10 megawatt threshold that this bill specifies, but will be operational before the 2028 start date, so it wouldn't apply. But any future project over 10 megawatts could be subject to this new renewable energy tax along with the public utility tax. We're continuing to assess whether specific exemptions written into the bill may apply to the utility or if we need additional clarity in the statute for future sessions. This bill also passed both chambers and is moving to the governor.
Another tax.
Well, it's just frustrating that things sort of come up so quickly. I mean, they have so much to do in such a limited amount of time. So,
and I will say this is...
I'm sure it's an unintended consequence that it doesn't apply to us. I mean, I'm assuming.
Yes, and I think the again, this has been an issue that's been particularly prevalent on the eastern side of the state,
right,
where a lot of these larger solar and wind projects are going in, and there has been this property tax shift that's been going on that has created a situation where a lot of local entities have wanted to put moratoriums down. And so that's the goal. I think, again, there's for future clarity that we want to search out and how this tax would apply.
Opportunities.
Exactly. As with any session, there are a few bills that we were watching that ultimately did not advance this year. We'll start at the top with HB 2275, which would have created a wildfire prevention and protection fund overseen by the state and funded by utilities to pay for third-party wildfire damages. Next was Senate Bill 2515, addressing cost concerns for emerging large energy use facilities, such as data centers. And then finally, there was SB 6008, which would have created a residential battery incentive program under the Department of Commerce, and Senate Bill 6004, which would have updated public utility contracting language to reflect generation definitions within the Clean Energy Transformation Act. Well, nothing is guaranteed. These topics could easily resurface next session, especially during, especially those with emerging large loads and wildfire damages, both high interest issues statewide. To close out today's report, I wanted to touch briefly on the supplemental budgets. As a reminder, these are mid-biennium adjustments to the operating, capital, and transportation budgets adopted last year. The conference bills were released last week, passed both chambers, and are now headed to the governor for his consideration. While we're still digging through the detail, some of the finer details, here are the top line numbers. $80.2 billion for the operating budget, which was a $2.4 billion increase from what they passed last year. 890 million for the capital budget, and then 16.6 billion for the transportation budget.
Are those up as well?
It's capital and transportation are a little bit more challenging to tell you exactly the difference between last year and this year, since the way that they calculate those numbers. If you would like, I'm happy to get to it. We're going to continue to review the specific line items within the budget, and I will provide a complete summary and the final recap that you'll get in your packet in a couple of weeks. That concludes your key legislation report for the 2026 session. As I mentioned earlier, once the governor wraps up his bill signing work in early April, I'll be sending you a comprehensive recap in your packet. Before I leave, I do want to just mention how much of a privilege it is to be representing the PUD in front of down in Olympia. This completes my fourth session with lawmakers and stakeholders, and the PUD is a respected and appreciated voice in all of these discussions. I really want to thank all the various teams that receive a bunch of emails to me, particularly late at night, to review pending legislation that's typically in a committee hearing the following morning. So I appreciate everybody from power supply to energy and customer services, key accounts, human resources, rates, finance, accounting, contracting, legal, emerging tech, as well as long-term planning and E&E. It really is an honor to be part of this team, elevating the insights of our staff and specific proposals, and being an advocate for our ratepayers and our customers. And with that, I'll take any last questions.
Do you have any commentary on the 25-hour closing debate?
Oh, the 25 on the millionaire's tax. Yeah. I think get out your popcorn. Well, it's going to be a fascinating year. Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
But it's all sessions end with a little bit of drama, and that was an interesting one to watch.
So, yeah, I watched 2 hours,
but
yeah, it's gonna stay awake.
It's always an interesting strategy, right? It's like how long can you go into the night? Yeah. When does somebody call uncle?
We'll see how that particular piece of legislation.
Again, get out your popcorn. It should be an interesting year.
I have a quick question. So. The five key bills, one the governor signed, do you anticipate the others will be signed as well?
I would anticipate at this point that the governor will sign the other ones right now. I think the one that I'm more interested in to see is with 1903, which is the energy assistance program. We have to go through the budget just to see if they appropriated those dollars. There is 30 million, I looked this morning, there is 30 million for energy assistance programs. It's just a question of, is that earmarked this? Is it go to something else? And I think that's where I'm very curious to see what the government wants to do there.
Well, thank you for all your hard work. I can't believe it's 4 years.
I know. It seems like it flies by, right?
Just good.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you, Ryan. Really appreciate all your work on the state legislative front. Next up is MEP and a Connect Up Urban Update.
They lower the mic. A bit shorter than Ryan. Morning, Commissioners. Here, Tim Epp, Program Director for Connect Up, here to give you a quarterly update on where things are at on this program. So no decisions to be made today, just keeping you all informed. And we'll cover program status, deployment status. I want to start bringing business case progress back to the board, as we made a lot of business case talk at the beginning. So I'd like to share some of our progress in those areas, and then give you an overview of what's some of the latest activities going on with our operating the AMI system and with our Connect Up 2.0 items. So costs, we are still holding close to that 93 million while I put this presentation together, but I'm going to asterisk this and I'm going to come back to it, because we do have some things that are adding some pressure to that. And I believe we are going to go higher than that. So I'll come back to that in a little bit. Water meter deployment, you know, that's complete. Our AMI plan network upgrade or installation is complete. Right now, two of our top risks are staffing levels. And that's because our deployment team is staffed with temporary employees. And as we get closer and closer to the end, we will probably see some of those temporary staff start to jump ship as they're looking for longer term employment. So I do expect that we'll have to work a little bit harder on some of that. We have some mitigation plans transitioning meter readers as their work starts to fade away. We have a staffing group there that we can tap into, but it is something that we'll be actively managing closely through the rest of the deployment. Repair costs are also coming in higher than originally forecasted. So that's where, looking at the projected spend, that is one area of pressure that we're seeing. I'll have an update for the board. I've got some deeper analysis I need to do. So I will come back next time with a report.
The question I had is how much higher.
I think that's an important aspect, though.
It's turned out to be, yeah, very important. So keeping customers back in power, I know it's very disruptive for us to show up to replace a meter and we tell them, you know, hey, your power's going to be off for maybe 5 minutes. And then it's hours.
Yeah, but not days.
But
not days. It is not days.
Well, I think that's so
important. But this is the program where the utility puts the bill.
Correct. This was a temporary policy that we asked the board to approve at the beginning of the program to step a little across the line that we normally have in terms of customer versus utility responsibilities.
And you're getting positive response to that, right?
Yes, we are.
I would think good for you are.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And a safety issue.
Moving on, we hit a milestone. So at the end of last week, we hit our 200,000th electric meter install. So that's a big mark. I have a note on there, and that is I'm adjusting our target for number of meters installed. So as I calculate that percentage complete, we are taking a look at how much meter growth that we have had since we originally put this program together. And that is the other reason for an upward pressure on price on the spending of overall of the program. When we originally put the program together, we anticipated a deployment period of through end of 2024. We have 2.5 more years of growth in that window to account for. So I'm truing that up, and with that will come increase in overall program cost.
But that cost shouldn't really be associated with the business case, right? That cost should be associated with adding new construction like we would.
Yes, I would agree. Yeah,
this endeavor.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
It's a good observation.
Yeah. Yeah, the benefit of actually taking those costs into the program is that we've negotiated a price for the meters.
Oh, of course.
Back in 2021. And so we continue to buy at that rate, even these growth. So if we didn't do that, we'd be buying at a much higher rate than we're currently paying.
And we're not going to tell.
Yep.
We're going to buy some inventory too, right?
Load up.
The program's done.
Yeah.
So
that'll be some of the deeper analysis I bring back to the board next time along the repair data. We are deploying in Linwood, Briar, Mount Lake Terrace, and Bothell still. This is our highest density area, that Southwest County. You see on that chart up there, each one of those circles is a pie chart, and they represent a meter reading route. So you can, if you squint really hard, you'll see that some of them are not completely blue. Blue is the color of completion. And so that indicates that there will be go back. We still have some tough meters and tough situations to mop up. That is a normal part of these deployment projects. So that'll be a chunk of the work that spills into 2027.
It says
ESMA. Oh, that's a map default. What's that?
My meter ain't bitchy.
No, not yet.
Are they all the meters around you?
Yeah.
That would be the test.
Might be a data thing.
I probably heard that.
Challenge of asking. Maybe it's going to be a big party. They're going to come to your house.
I hope not.
John will come to your house. They're waiting for John's scheduling.
Golden meter. Yeah.
Golden meter.
Absolutely not.
Derek can have 1 meter. It's a sliver of 1 inch.
So we still do anticipate being 90% complete by the end of this year, and we'll finish up the remaining 10% in the first half of next year, along with those challenging meters. And then we'll have our program closeout activities. One of those closeout activities will be taking a look at how many opt-out customers we do have, taking a look at what is it actually costing for those opt-out reads, and probably come back to the board with a refresh of what our rates are for charging for opt-out. Opt-out rate is still continues to hold very steady. I think we fluctuated between 0.3 and 0.35%. So right now it's a little bit lower. It'll still continue to fluctuate a little bit. It's staying really tight, which is making end program planning easier.
Well, there's a lot of urban area that still need to be connected.
Correct. We still have certainly
perhaps
downtown Everett.
The opt-out rate won't be as high.
It might not, because apartment buildings are not allowed to opt out. That's definitely a factor in that, how that rate plays out. So it tends to balance out some of the other areas where we see perhaps a little bit higher rate in the single family zones.
Okay.
So on the business case, a couple things that I wanted to highlight. The largest portion of the business case did have to do with FTE reductions. And so I did want to share with the board that our meter reading staffing levels are down. We peaked at 69. The board may recall that we had, when we first went into the program and did the business case, at that time we were contracting out quite a bit of our meter reading. And so we had counted that contract cost. In the meantime, we've actually ended that contract, brought on staffing to cover that. So that boosted our staffing levels up to that 69 level, but we are now down to 45. So we are continuing to move on the promises that we made to the board about staffing levels with respect to reading. Data quality is another area that we anticipated improvements. This is not always a dollar cost savings on the business case, but definitely a benefit. Customers are appreciating the fact that we are not estimating bills like we had to in the past. We're getting a benefit internally about data discrepancies. So we're able to tell more now when we have some record keeping on about equipment in the field that's not correct. For instance, you know, do we have a three-phase transformer or a single-phase transformer? Every once in a while, we'll catch a little error with data from AMI that you might not have expected. So getting some good benefits there. And then, of course, I think I've mentioned this one in the past as well, confirming transformer size sufficiency. So we do have information where, and say a new customer comes in, wants to connect or, you know, build a home and add to an existing transformer, our engineers are able to do a check to make sure that the transformer that's there is sufficiently sized for that new customer, or go ahead and make the move to upsize that transformer.
Through the data.
Through the data that we have, yeah. So where we do have AMI meters, that's a benefit that we have in place now.
So are we starting to look at areas where there isn't necessarily new growth, but just to understand if transformers are sized appropriately throughout the system? Because I know that's been a challenge too, as people look at cars and air conditioners.
Yeah, we did do some broad analysis looking at, you know, where we do have AMI. And right now things actually look good for the district. We are not in a crisis stage with respect to transformer sizing. We are working with our system planning group, though, to also feed in AMI data so that they can roll that into their planning models and be able to forecast better for the longer range even.
So in the future, will staff be able to look at a feeder and automatically roll up all the AMI data up to 15-minute increment and understand for that whole feeder, transformer, whatever, I don't know all lingo, what's happening on that one, what the load is, what the peaks are?
Yeah, not only at a feeder level, but even down at segment levels, we'll be able to do that. So that's some of this work that I've mentioned with system planning. It is, yeah. Our data and analytics team is also working on some analysis to look for patterns of usage across our customer base. to start to spot different types of patterns, which will be very useful for our rates team for rates analysis and other opportunities to evaluate the loading that we've got on the grid. Good stuff. Another benefit has to do with connect disconnect. Some of this is financial benefit for the district and reduced write-offs. We struggle with what, you know, when a customer moves out, we don't always get that news. And so, you know, energy is running in that house. We have the ability to now schedule if a customer tells us they're moving out, we can turn the power off. Customer says they're moving in, we can schedule that turn on, or we can turn it on right then for them. So no impact to customers, but energy saving for the district when nobody's on the hook for that power. So good benefit there. I think the other good benefit is for customers that are experiencing dunning, disconnect for non-paid, we're able to get them back in power as soon as they've made payment arrangements or they've paid their bills. We're able to, what used to take, could take hours, could cost extra. This is a benefit, I think a big benefit for some of those customers that we're able to get them back on. No more charges for rolling trucks. Mm-hmm. We're able to connect them right away.
So did they pay a reconnect fee then?
No more.
Is that a man?
No. Yeah.
That's huge for them. Yeah. And just imagine apartment complex and stuff. It's got to make it so much straightforward to turn off one tenant, turn on the next tenant.
Yeah.
A minute later or whatever it is.
Yeah, much better. So looking at our operations, the team is supporting our SnowSmart program. So there's a lot of work going on to support the DA communications and other outage alert integration that will be happening under the SnowSmart umbrella. Daily, we take a look at our data and make sure that everything is going smoothly, supporting, you know, quality meter communications, accurate billing, and interval reads presentment to our customers. There's quite a bit that is going on during deployment. We have data setting up new meters across multiple systems. So there's a higher likelihood of things going awry. So we have a team that keeps an eye on that every single day. I would expect some of that activity to die off once we're fully deployed. But the team's doing a great job keeping an eye on things. We did have some storm damage from a December storm at one of our network sites. Fortunately, because we build our network towers, we use ductile iron poles now for most of our base station sites. That damage was limited, and so an easy repair for us to be able to make. So,
are they susceptible to storm damage as much as other parts of the community?
Yeah, it is, in the sense that in most of the places that we put these network towers up, we were replacing an existing pole with a power attachment.
Okay.
So to the extent that pole was always susceptible. I think I mentioned already before, support for rates, portfolio planning. That's definitely a big benefit to us being able to get this interval data. So team is actively working to support that. And then we're also preparing for the SAP upgrade and all the changes that will be coming with that to connect our AMI reads to the new system. So that is all the content that I prepared. Other questions I can have?
Not a question, just clarification. I thought I heard you say your next update will have a little bit more in depth.
I will, yes, I will bring
based upon,
yeah, I will bring more information about the growth meters driving up cost, as well as repair increases and how that's impacted.
Okay, and you mentioned the overall budget. Did you say that you bring?
Yeah, so that those two,
the growth,
yes, that supporting an increase in that bottom line.
Thank you.
It's a teaser, so we come watch the next one. I've got a couple of questions.
Sure.
Customers making use of the ability to change their billing date?
They are not as much as we thought they might want to. So one of the things that we've got on our list to consider is enabling that choice online, so they don't have to call in. They could actually make that choice from the MySnowPud customer portal. But that's not actually been taken up by as many customers that we've seen.
So this is connected to my next question, and I'm wondering, when we switch a home over, do we try to set that reading date, quote unquote, to be similar to what it has been, or do they get a new one? And the reason I'm asking is, you know, social media is sort of a hard place, but there's a lot of comments, like in my neighborhood, in my city now, where meters are starting to get installed. So, you know, people say, oh, my bill is so much higher. The meter is causing my bill to be higher. Of course, the meter can't have changed your bill by maybe 1%, possibly, but there's something. But, you know, it's more likely that people just don't know how much energy they're using this winter. But I was wondering if they had a 30-day cycle, and for their first bill is a 40-day cycle. And
yeah, that absolutely can be a factor, getting more predictable. I don't have the specifics on how we set that new rate. I would assume, or the new schedule, I would assume it's tied probably to the setup of that new account.
Yeah.
You know, they could choose to do otherwise, but you're right. I do think the variation that we've seen in billing windows can be a factor in understanding how much a bill is. There can be outliers. There can be analog meters do slow down over time.
Yeah.
And so there could be a handful of cases. And, you know, if we have customers like that, I'd strongly urge them to reach out and talk to us about those kind of cases if they have questions about that. But in most cases, it would be almost negligible difference, you know, in terms of a bill amount.
And there's often on these long threads, many customers are waiting and say their bill hasn't changed. I mean, we see the same thing around rates, right?
Because we do.
My bill in the winter, they say, well, you need to raise the rates.
Yeah.
Say, well, we haven't raised the rates.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's just how disconnected people are
from
consumption to their cost. And obviously, this program gives some tools for
people. Yeah, it's going to be much easier to be able to get down to an apples to apples comparison.
Yeah, and I think to your point, typically, if we have a cold December, cold January, which we did, even before AMI, we would get, you know, an uptick in calls to the call center for people complaining about high bills.
Yeah.
This is just, you know, something that they can point to and try to draw that correlation. But again, we went back and did an analysis, and I'm not suggesting we do, but if you looked at the temperatures, you know, weather related, what's driving the uptick in usage relative to old standard meter or a new meter, and how our customers are responding, I think you'd see a similarity. It's not the meter, it's the other factors.
Great. Any other questions?
Another factor that would play is must be playing into it is on the national level. What's happening? Energy and electricity prices. I saw in one of our publications, I was doing one of my Power Sunday meeting sessions, and it really is amazing, the Pacific Northwest, how they're not reasonable. To the customer, they're not, but if they were to look over other parts of the country, I was shocked.
Yeah, that is big news right now.
But it's in the news all the time. So I would think our customers might see that and say, well.
I think so. And I think sometimes people don't even know who they're buying their power from. Their spouse pays the bill. And so we've got regionally some big rate increases with our neighbors. I think with the national conversation, like you say, I mean, I've had so many people say, well, all these problems, our rates are going up with electric cars. It's like, really a pretty small act and potentially helpful to shift load. Thank you. Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, great job, Kim.
It's so funny because for the longest time we were just barely getting meters and never going to get started.
I know.
And boom, we're halfway there. Yeah. Water's done.
Yeah, it's moving.
Here.
Yeah, we're at like 4,000 a week is our install rate right now. Sometimes we climb up into the 5,000 a week. So.
Wow,
that's a lot.
It is a lot. Thank you, Commissioner.
Yeah,
excellent, Tim. Thank you. Okay.
Just a great opportunity to make contact with every customer.
Yeah.
Have a PD employee. really every customer's house knocks on the door.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really powerful.
It is.
Yeah.
Very powerful. All right. Next up is our strategic 2028 to 2032 strategic plan development roadmap. Laura Lemke. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
Laura.
Good morning, John. Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
Laura Lemke, Program Director in the Government Relations and Strategic Planning Department. And I'm here this morning to brief you on our 2028 to 2032 Strategic Plan Development Roadmap. I promise this won't be as long as it was last meeting.
Actually, Tony enjoys
that. Excellent. So starting now on the strategic plan gives us the runway that we need to be ready to start implementation right out of the gate in 2028. So even though it feels like a two-year development timeline is fairly long, it actually gives us the ability to do the deep thinking that we want to do and then do the prioritization and planning that we need to do in 2027 to be prepared for 2028. This presentation is just a briefing. There's no decision needed from you today. It's informational. Ask me questions as we go. So the intended outcome of this effort is to develop our next five-year strategic plan. It will cover 2028 to 2032. It took me a while to wrap my head around the fact that we're planning for the 2030s at this point. We are not starting from scratch this time around. We have a strategic plan. We've done the foundational work of revisiting and reaffirming our purpose, our vision, our values, our commitment to our community in terms of our anchors, and setting our strategic priorities. So this plan is being done in context of that work. So some of the work that we did in 2021, where we were having those conversations, we won't be doing this time around. We'll be using or taking those as a starting point. And then as we get into the work in 2027, early in the year, we may reaffirm some of those. We might make some small language adjustments. But right now, we're assuming that the work that we did then carries us forward. So over the next 18 months, we'll be engaging the commission, district leadership, employees, and external stakeholders to ensure that we're capturing what people think is important and focus on the right things. I already talked about how we're going to leverage what we've learned and build with the current plan. And then we're going to make some key process changes to the way that we do the work internally in terms of developing our scenarios, prioritizing critical capabilities, and then identifying our initiatives to just increase plan clarity and ensure that we all know what it is we're saying we're going to do and how we'll know if we're successful. There are six sort of key elements, five key elements plus a celebration. So we are starting this year with scenario development. We'll be thinking about what could our communities look like in 2045, how would the way that they look and what they need from us change, and combining that with thinking about what our region and operating environment might look like. We'll be doing four scenarios this time around. In 2021, we did five scenarios. This time we're sort of narrowing the scope a little bit just because best practice is four scenarios, and I'm not sure that we got the benefit that we hoped for out of having a fifth the last time. Once we've written those scenarios and brought them back to you, we will be doing our scenario planning work in the end of this year. And those are those live in the futures workshops where we invite people to come in and spend a day imagining what it looks like and feels like to live in that version of 2045. We ask them, what would it take to be successful, for the district to be successful, to just be a resident or an employee living in that world? And then we identify what capabilities we would need to be successful. What are the resources we have, the skills we have to have, some of the programs? We don't get down into the details. This isn't we need a device that does X, Y, and Z. It might be things like we need the ability to, utilize satellite technology for communications rather than Wi-Fi. Picking up an example. From there, we'll roll into setting our five-year strategic objectives for the strategic plan. We will also, as part of that conversation, reaffirm that our five strategic priorities are still the right priorities to carry us forward. Those strategic objectives will also have key metrics associated with them so that we know whether or not we're making the progress that we want to make. Once we've identified the objectives, moving into late Q1, early Q2 of 2027, we will identify the strategic initiatives that we need in order to meet those objectives. Some of those initiatives will be work that's already in progress that we've started under this strategic plan that's continuing into the next plan, or that is sort of phase two of something that we're doing now. And some of it will be newer. We'll bring you that strategic plan, hopefully kind of mid to late summer of next year, in alignment with the timing from when you see the budget and rates and all of those types of things. So we'll be having that as much as possible as we can as a singular conversation. And the goal is to be getting to the point where we've got a final plan, a pretty public document, all of those types of things, and a resolution to adopt it in October or November of 2027. That was a lot. Questions on any of that?
No, I think future stuff.
Future stuff. Got it. Okay. So moving forward, because that's a lot, and it's hard to see how the pieces are all moving back and forth between the commission, the executive leadership team, and staff. We've got a couple of slides here that actually lay out the deliverables and the workflow for the next 2 years. So in 2026, as you can see, and we'll talk more at the end, I'm starting with after this meeting. So April 7th, I'll be back. We'll talk about strategic foresight and scenario planning in preparation for a workshop with you and the executive leadership team on April 16th. That's going to inform our development of our 2045 scenarios. And there's a lot of internal workshops and research and thinking that's going into identifying the trends and the weak signals and key uncertainties that could influence the way we write those scenarios. We anticipate briefing the ELT about what those scenarios are in July and then bringing them back to you in either late July or early August. If you recall, in 2021, we brought them to you and we talked you through what those scenarios were and what the early implications of them were. In the fall, we'll be doing those scenario planning workshops that I already talked about. The reason that that box is green with a yellow outline with a purple outline is that we do anticipate including the ELT and the commission in those workshops in a way that we didn't do in 2021. And rather than drawing the box three times, I just made it a box with multiple colors. And then, as you can see, that rolls us into the end of Q4, where we'll be identifying those critical capabilities and bringing you that briefing and conversation at the end of the year.
This is such a logical way to do this. I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
I think the idea of doing the 2045 scenario development is just so powerful, because there's very common things that come up in different scenarios. Just help us focus on what to do.
It gets us out of our assumptions about what the future is going to look like and the decisions that we need to make now to be successful then. If we can challenge our thinking a little bit about the way things like AI or others might unfold and what that might look like for our communities.
Right. We're not just building black cars and thinking we'll just keep building black cars.
No Model Ts here.
No one ever going to want color.
Observation.
Yes.
While I do support the board's involvement in this next iteration, as the board is introduced to this, we look at it through a little bit different lens than from an operational standpoint. Mm-hmm. And does the board need any preparation for that? So that a more effective use of time can be made. Am I creating a problem? That I think it is a bit of a hurdle for me that I don't jump from high level future strategic vision
into
the operation.
And it's a great question. And we've been doing a lot of thinking about how do we engage the board, the leadership team, employees into the right level of the conversation. Yeah. And so the reason I'll be back next week is to talk really about what is strategic foresight, what is scenario planning, how do we develop our scenarios to prepare the board for the workshop on the 16th. Might give you some pre-work you can do if you'd like to, and that type of thing, to set us all up for success for the right conversations in that room and keep us at the right level. And then same thing before we would do the scenario planning workshops. I think our intent there is to include you sort of at the beginning of the day. What does this world look like? What does it feel like? And at the end of the day, to hear the recommendations from the people that spent the day in that world and where they landed. And we would use that briefing in August the same way to talk about here are the scenarios, here's what the workshops look like, here's what we're asking.
Excellent. Identifying those things, but from the policymaker's perspective, I suggest that you seek our feedback in terms of what have you heard, how have you interpreted this, so that we go in with a clear understanding. Because for this old girl, I'll jump to operations in a nanosecond, and you don't want me in there. So am I making myself?
I think so. I mean, I guess I've always thought we would be looking at really big picture things.
We are.
We want a utility prepared for the future.
Right. But
I want us to be
a positive addition.
Yeah.
And this was in the process. And as you'll recall, in the past, that hasn't been too successful because I don't think the full board had an appreciation for their role.
I will.
So that's all I have to say.
Thank you for the comments.
Can I get my point across?
Yep. We will appreciate all of that into consideration as we design this. So that's 2026. By the end of this year, we're going to have Imagine 2045 in multiple ways and identified what it takes to be successful across multiple versions of that future and prioritizing the things that are important in most or all of them. The key change you will see here from the 2021 work to now is that there we just brought you, I don't want to say a laundry list, but I went back and looked at it. We brought you four slides, four pages of fairly small font, and said, here are all the things we think are important. This time around, we're planning to do the work ahead of time to bring you a smaller list and say, these are the ones that we really think are critical capabilities that we either need to build, maintain, or improve, strengthen. So that'll be a specific change that you see in addition to the fact that we're only doing four scenarios. And the key change there is we're only doing one collapse scenario. We only get one dark version of the future. In 2027, we will move from those critical capabilities to affirming the strategic priorities and drafting the objectives. I already talked through all of this, so I'm not going to repeat myself. But you can see again that we would, similar to the way we did this in 2022, there would be an internal kind of more operations policy focused conversation, and we would bring you our thinking in February of 27 for you to react to from a policy standpoint and add your ideas to help us identify any gaps. From there, we will move into stakeholder feedback, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about in a moment, and then developing our actual strategic initiatives. Those are a series of workshops like what we did in 2022, where for each objective, we do a workshop, we say, what work has to be done or completed to actually achieve this. Another key change there will be ensuring that we have identified what the success criteria is for every initiative in more detail than we did the last time around. And from there, then we'll bring it back to you for review. It says September there, hedging my bets a little bit, but I anticipate being here in July and August. And then getting that plan finalized in October, doing the pretty version, the polished version, and then the resolution to adopt it in November of 2027.
Commissioner, to further your conversation about operational aspects, I think one thing that will be important is operational things are in budget. Think budget, so it'll be important to understand 2045 future, the pieces we need, and as we do the build those pieces, the cost associated. So I think we need that, at least that understanding. We're going to do X, and X is,
fiduciary responsibility to the owners.
But I think that's really where it ties in. It's a fiduciary responsibility. Okay, sorry.
Not interrupting.
That's just right on to what we should be looking
at. Yes, I agree.
And that's the intent of the timing of trying to bring it to you in the summer of 27. So that it's in alignment, so that you can see the immediate impacts for 28 and that type of thing.
Yeah.
So moving on from there, I think it's important to just communicate what does it look like internally for us to do the development on this. And so our governance structure has sort of three teams working in concert, plus everybody that we're inviting to workshops. So there's a strategic plan core team. There are four people on that team for 2026. We have added 5 additional team members that we're calling our strategic foresight team. Those 2 teams on the left are operating as 1 team for this year. So there are 9 of us shepherding this project through the process. We kicked off about 6 weeks ago, and we're already having a ton of fun debating external forces and trends and uncertainties and what it could mean in the future. And if you extrapolate the way they intersect 20 years from now, what does that really look like? And then differently than the way we did this 5 years ago, we are standing up a strategic plan advisor team. There's functionally 1 representative from each one of our divisions, plus a couple of additional people to make sure we're getting a broad enough perspective. And they will serve as sort of our front line reviewers, questioners, challenging our thinking and our assumptions, helping us identify gaps or unintended downstream consequences. We're asking them to take an enterprise level view in their conversations, as opposed to sort of fighting and advocating for what their division wants in it. And so we kicked off with them yesterday. I'm really excited about it. And so that's the way we're operating internally for the development of this. From an external stakeholder engagement standpoint, we are planning to go out to external stakeholders in March or April of next year. We will, similarly to what we did in 2022, take them the draft strategic priorities and objectives for the plan and ask them to affirm to us whether or not those align with what they think they need over the next 5, 10, 15 years, and help us identify any concerns and real or perceived gaps. We will probably do this similarly to the way we did the last time around. So by engaging a wide variety of stakeholders and meeting them in the places where they already expect to interact with us. We talk a little bit more detail about that. So if we look at this list of external stakeholder types or segments, last time around for the top 4, so governments, regional partners, community partners, and our key CNI customers, the person who's their internal contact reached out to them, provided them a copy of the draft, and invited them to give us feedback or ask for a conversation. And so we did that as a one-on-one interaction with them, as opposed to trying to schedule forums and roundtables and all of that type of thing that allowed them to have the conversation that they did or didn't want to have with us about it. For the small and mid-sized businesses and the residential customers, we used more kind of broad communications approach there, where we had it included in the monthly email that goes out, the bill stuffer, it was on the website, utilize social media, that type of thing, and ask for feedback from them that way.
So for the residential and small businesses, you don't anticipate any group sessions?
I don't anticipate, or I don't plan to do those at this point.
I think it's, first of all, hard to get people to come.
It's hard to get people to come, and Garrison Marr, Senior Manager of Power Supply, and I have been talking about the intersection of the IRP process and the strategic planning process. And through the IRP process, they do a lot of public engagement, and so we will leverage some of that. But I don't plan to schedule specific sessions and open houses for people to come in and talk to us about the strategic plan.
Well, your elected officials will immediately go to that kind of activity, and from experience, you can't get them there unless you pay them. And we have, I should say this, Mr. Lawyer, we paid them the game. So I don't know if that was the right thing to do or not. And we still only had a room of 10 people.
Right. And that's why
I'm going abroad.
And in talking to other utilities the last time around, and our experience when we did this 5 years ago, is that meeting customers, showing up where customers expect to see us in their bill stuffer, right, in their monthly wire communication, and maybe at events, that type of thing, is where they're expecting to see us. And that sets us up for success in terms of not throwing a party that nobody comes to. You might recall we did that in Stanwood a number of years ago. And also ensuring that we catch their attention when they're thinking about us. So finally, looking ahead, we already talked about this, but I will be back in 2 weeks for the next meeting. We'll be doing a little bit of a more academic briefing around what is strategic foresight and what is scenario planning? How are we planning to utilize them? What does it look like to give us input into how we think about those scenarios and what we'll be asking you to do as part of that workshop. And the workshop will then be the afternoon of April 16th with the commission and the executive leadership team. And that will be one of those really great and fun workshops with post-it notes and flip charts and markers and maybe even some voting stickers. Going old school on that one.
Can't work AI into that.
A big wheel we can spin, maybe.
I wasn't planning on it, but if you really want to be wheel,
we want to be more focused and less our. We go this way.
And then just so that you, I believe it was in the email that Allison sent, but just so that you're aware, in the room will be the commission and the executive leadership team and the strategic foresight team. We'll be working as a team to facilitate that session. It won't just be the Laura Lemke show. Be a lot of other people there contributing in meaningful ways. With that, my last slide is, do you have any other questions for me today?
Questions?
Sure. Oh, a million, but I, as we move into it, this is something that I'm very, 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 fascinates me. And like you said, I have never experienced anything to this depth, and the importance of the pre-work before you publish something is it's commendable. Doggone it, it is really, and I know a lot of fun.
Thank you. A lot of fun as well.
I'd love to appreciate
it. Absolutely. It's pretty impressive. And impressive how we use it.
We work hard to make sure it's integrated into the way we're thinking about running the business and the decisions we're making.
Integrated. It feeds into work. It feeds into, I mean, there's all, you can go through the whole history and it's like, okay.
Which feeds into my only question, which is really for John. So, John, talk about how staffing gets driven by a strategic plan. And as we go one direction or another, are we prepared to staff departments more or other departments less? Or what are your thoughts about how we...
High level, it really, once we've determined whatever the strategic objectives and then more specifically the strategic initiatives, then you have to look at what resources does it take to accomplish those initiatives, as well as the kind of ongoing daily work.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the bigger projects you look at to the cloud, right? Christy and I were just talking about this the other day. That's going to drain. We've got SnowSmart, ConnectUp, to the cloud that are all going on at the same time. We will be going on at the same time. Huge drain on resources. Some of it is, how do you just prioritize projects, which we've also, that's why we stood up to the project governance team and figure out how do you, you know, align and synchronize the projects and the work according to your resource capability. And it's kind of putting all that together, and we're still trying to refine that process even down to, you know, kind of deeper within the strategic plan and the work that's going on. We're with our work management, project management, on just kind of the daily activities of building substations or building new line, or out in generation, you know, managing the workload, understanding our resources and resource capabilities to get the work done in the necessary amount of time, and prioritizing that, you know, what lines do we have to have built, you know, in order to serve customers? What lines do we have to have built in order to, you know, make sure our system is, you know, able to handle the load and built for resiliency and reliability? Yeah.
I guess my reflection was it's easy to build and add staffing for something. Sometimes it can be challenging to reduce or redistribute staffing
mm-hmm.
as needed, because part of the business has changed. We made it more efficient. And,
mm-hmm. Yep. No, yeah, that's a great point, great question. And, you know, one of the things that we've done is try to mature our, one, visibility to where our FTE needs and our HR group. Sharon and team built a dashboard for us that gives us a lot of insight on how we're trending. We actually this year established, you know, not to exceed FTE, because it is easy to drift and just hire more people as the additional work, or what we think is additional work, even though it may not be necessarily a straight add. It may be because we're not going to do other things, or the some of these things are higher priority. So we're trying to scrutinize all that and be deliberate and intentional on making sure we're managing the, you know, the headcount and resources appropriately.
Any other questions?
No. And I look forward to it.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll be back next week with some nerdery around thinking about the future.
Sequels coming shortly.
Thank you, Laura. As always, amazing job. That is it for the presentations today.
That brings us into our item four, our CEO General Manager report for today.
I do. All items to share. First off, in our corporate communications, Kevin Davis, our lead safety specialist, and Keith Ellison, the Linwood Operations Superintendent, joined Kelly Stickney to present on storm preparedness and high voltage safety to the Linwood Police Department volunteers. Our Linwood Police Department, these volunteers routinely help with road closures during storms or carpool hits, carpool incidents, and are oftentimes on the front line when those situations can be very hazardous. So it's great to see us out in the community helping these first responders stay safe. Also out of CorpCom helped with an award and a big check presentation for Primera, who earned this year's Most Energy Saved Award. Thank you to Commissioner Logan, who joined them for the photo opportunity to celebrate the partnership that resulted in many no-cost or low-cost energy efficiency improvements that saved Primera over $20,000 in energy savings in just 1 year. This was the result of the great work by Rob McManus and Kelsey Lewis through the Commercial Strategic Management Program. And then from our Customer and Energy Services, the Community Ribbon, this is just a heads up, the Community Ribbon Cutting Ceremony and Celebration for the El Sol South Everett Solar Project is officially scheduled for Saturday, September 19th. While the project has been online since December of 2024, this family-friendly event will feature the project's community-led art project with contributions from local artists and children, in addition to remarks from our local community leaders. And then lastly, some good news. The Arlington City Council last night did vote to approve the granting the easement for the Crosswind transmission line. And I just wanted to acknowledge and give a huge thank you and kudos to the folks that were there last night, which was Andrew Flaherty, Jessica Spar, Brenda White, and I think Brenda has left, Eric Carnegie, who is here. Raise your hand, Eric. Jennifer Southard, who was also there. Again, huge kudos to this team. Also, Ben Davis and Maureen Gannon have been involved, heavily involved in this project. It has been a lift and a little bit of a slog to get there, but they did it. And I'm super impressed with the team and how they just persevered to make sure that we were able to get that line put in the spot where it's cost effective and yet will certainly bring about the reliability and resiliency that we need for our system, especially in the North County area. So, yeah, super proud of the team.
Questions for
you? Awesome. You had another one. Did you have another one?
No.
Well, you can make one up.
Yeah, I can.
I had my wheeze this morning. Can you
didn't want to, I think. Based off the content. Do you have any comments?
No.
Okay. A couple. First, it was nice to go to the Primera big check thing, and really to see how appreciated our staff were. Their staff, our staff, were, you know, I spent time with each other. Really, their CEO was incredibly impressed, and also impressed that we took the time to go there for a photo op for them as well. So it was just neat to see, you know, a little bit of the backside of that program.
Yeah,
and then well, thank you to everybody that worked on the Arlington. I watched the previous meeting, and the staff did a great job. And I cut the recording off your first part of your comments. I missed. I'm glad you were there, and you couldn't have been any tighter vote. And so I appreciate that. It's never taken for granted what can happen. So,
yeah,
huge project.
Yes.
Interesting. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right. Next, item 5, public hearing action. 5A, disposal of surplus property, second quarter 2026. I'll call for a motion.
Based on staff's recommendation that the items are no longer necessary or useful to the district, I move that those items listed on exhibits A and B of the surplus property recommendation report be declared surplus and be sold for high bid or disposed of according to policy in the second quarter 2026.
Okay, I'll now convene a public hearing. Audience Lazar, available to answer any questions. Are there any comments from the public regarding this resolution? Please raise your hand. See no hands up in the room, and I'm seeing no hands up online. Commissioner, do you have any questions or comments?
No, although I had to look up what Optillion equipment was.
A what?
Page 2, Optillion equipment. You know what that is? That's fiber, right?
I did look at the dates of some of these. We've hold on to some of these vehicles pretty well. I was impressed. Yeah.
173,000 miles. I don't think I'd like to drive it.
We also have something from 1996, so I think better life out of that. Well, hearing no questions or comments, I'll close the public hearing. I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Next, item 6A, consideration of a resolution authorizing the manager real estate services to execute all necessary documents for just 5 contiguous high voltage distribution easements from the city of Arlington, Washington, for the purpose of installing, maintaining and operating transmission and distribution lines that connect to the district's Crosswind substation located at 17601 59th Avenue Northeast, Arlington, Washington. I will call for a motion.
I move approval.
Ray Barnes is able to answer any questions regarding the resolution. We were thoroughly briefed on this. Discussed it?
Yes.
Any questions?
No.
I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passed unanimously. Next, item 7, commission reports. 7A, commission reports. Commission business is 7. Commission reports is 7A. Are there any reports?
I have none.
I don't have any. 7B, our commissioner event calendar, which is page 143 of our packet. Any changes to be made to the event calendar?
Something came up. No, I don't have it because I don't have the details.
I'm going to be doing Arbor Day in Everett for the second time. I did it my very first year.
Yeah, that I saw that.
I haven't done it since.
It's a fun thing to do.
It is. Especially if it's not right.
Where is it located this time?
Seems like it's always located by that park or by the water.
In the city of Everett, someplace.
Yeah. It's on my hill. That's what I do. Okay. Next, we'll move to item 8, our governance planning calendar. This begins on 154. Are there any changes to the governance planning calendar? Remind me what ERMC is. EMRC policy update, new ERMC for its own slide.
Energy risk management or enterprise risk management.
Okay. Oh, by the way, we've gone past the commission reports, but I'd love that thing in the district daily, the lookup of all the terms and a bookmark.
Yeah.
That is super powerful.
So many.
I mean, there's a page and a half, I think, of A's. Thank you. Okay. Is there any further business to come before the board?
Can we take a look at our planning calendar?
Yeah.
okay.
That's what I just, yeah, that's what I was asking about here. Do you have any changes to the planning calendar?
Well, other than our strategic, maybe that's already in there. The calendar for.
Oh, for the next meeting?
I don't know.
Yeah, strategic foresight.
Yeah.
Scenario planning.
I do have an observation. I asked any other business, just an observation. Yeah. Back on the bid award report, I should have said that this earlier, but I must say that the fact that I didn't have any questions, big ticket items to purchase software and programs that need be updated. But the business case in each one of those, for each one of those items was very thorough. And I was quite impressed with it because they're large dollar items, but clearly good selections. Even some of those were staged with the same vendor for the reason why. So I wish I'd have remembered to do that when it was on our agenda.
Yeah, we did take a good deep dive into the
Yeah, but it was very well laid out, and maybe that's why I didn't come up with it then.
Yeah, appreciate those comments.
Okay, is there any further business to come before the board? Hearing none, seeing none, it is 10:21 a.m. and our meeting is adjourned.